Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. My name is Roy. My call sign is AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KT2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We offer original articles and reviews on many of the topics that are covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club's website, and the link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type. But if you would like a simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com, and we also have an Echo Link node available for use. Just point your Echo Link application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of every month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and an application is always readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with a word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any questions for future suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody out there. Roy, I don't know how this happens, but somehow your voice is coming through. I can completely understand everything you're saying, but it's incredible. It's like incredibly lower than usual. It's almost like off frequency, which of course doesn't happen on 2 meters. And I don't know what's going on. So it sounds almost like Darth Vader or something, but completely understandable. I can copy every word. Back to you.
Okay. I don't quite know what's going wrong, but I don't know. The signal seems to be looking reasonable, at least on my waveform on my screen. So we'll try and deal with it as best we can.
Yeah. Reception, like noise? No, not much noise at all. I mean, it's just your voice. That's it. Back to you. I mean, it's totally copyable. Back to you.
Okay. Well, there's one little thing I could try. So give me a second, and I'll be right back. Okay, this is my other option. Is this any better?
Unfortunately, it's exactly the same. I mean, people may just think, maybe people think you have a bad cold or something. But yeah, I guess we'll just go with it. It's just kind of interesting. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I do not have a clue, so we'll just have to go with it as best we can. And because I was kind of using a couple of filters to make the audio sound a little bit better, but then I bypassed them, theoretically, so apparently that's not what's causing any of this, so I don't know exactly what is. Anyway, I am AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We've been on hiatus for a little bit over a month. It was a nice little respite for me, but I hope people didn't forget all about the Technical Net, and I hope that there'll be some people. So I'll throw out the question. If anyone out there has any questions or topics for discussion tonight, please feel free, hit that push to talk, and ID yourselves. Okay, I think someone tried to get in, but they were about 99% noise. So if there's anything you can do to get better reach into the repeater, fiddle with your antenna if you have a whip and a handheld, or find some elevation, or go near to a window if you're inside, or raise the output power if you're capable of doing that to your transmitter, and try again. If not, consider that we do have an EchoLink available, so you can get in through the EchoLink. It's available for cell phones and PCs and all kinds of things, so consider that. Well, now it was about 98% noise, so it's an improvement, but I can't understand anything. So I'll give you an opportunity to kind of figure out if you can at all get a better signal into the repeater, and I'll tell what audience we might or might not have, things that I played around with technologically over the last month. Unfortunately, none of it was really amateur radio related. I was always a big fan of Harmony remotes, with those expensive programmable remotes that kind of took in all of your component systems, and you pushed a button and it turned all the right devices on and controlled them, and it had macros where one button could do five different things one after the other. It's a very nice remote control, a bit expensive. Unfortunately, Logitech thought it was a great company, so they bought it. And they drove it into the ground. They invested some money, invested some research and development, made it a little bit more sophisticated, took away its macros for some strange reason, and then finally figured out that it wasn't worth the trouble and discontinued the line. So you can't buy a Harmony remote anymore unless, you know, it's in the unboxed, you know, new, but, you know, it's been sitting on some retailer shelf. And everyone is kind of dreading the day that Logitech decides to unplug the server that runs the thing and turns it into a hockey puck. So that's Harmony remotes, unfortunately. No real company kind of took its place, but lately there are a few. One of them is a company called Sofa Baton, which is an interesting branding. You know, sofa, as in you sit in your sofa, and you use a baton if you're a conductor or whatever. So Sofa Baton is a brand name for a series of smart remote controls. I wasn't really that interested because when they first came out, they weren't that sophisticated. But as time has gone on, they've brought in more models and more sophistication, and they're able to do macros now, and they're able to do not only infrared, which was the only thing that the Harmony remotes could do, but they could also do Bluetooth controls. So my Apple TV, which can run on Bluetooth instead of infrared, I could use. And it even is capable of running on Wi-Fi. So my Sonos speaker system, which runs on Wi-Fi, can be remote controlled through that. But what interested me when I heard about it was the newest model has the ability to actually do some computer tricks. It can get into web servers. It does what's called an HTTP put and get. So you can actually send a signal to a web server any place on your network inside your house or outside that's accessible through web browsers and such. And if you're able to give the right command, you can do all kinds of things. So I can use the remote control to control my computers. I can simulate key presses and run applications and close applications and do all kinds of fun stuff. So I'm looking forward to playing with that aspect. I kept it simple the first week I got it and just set up devices, and then you could set up activities that the devices use. And so it's it looks like an interesting little toy to play with. Again, they tend to be more expensive than generic cheap Chinese remote controls. But, you know, I like gadgets. So I look forward to controlling my computers through my remote control. And you can even interface it with Alexa, and you can do all kinds of cross-home control things. So I'm really looking forward to that. So that's one of the things that I was playing around with. Hopefully that has given people enough time to remember that we're here and turn on the radio. But I have a few more stories if need be. So once again, I still continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for this, the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone out there has any questions about what I said or any other questions or comments, please feel free.
This is Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf. Will it replace the Team Viewer?
Remind me what Team Viewer is. Team Viewer to me, Team Viewer is a remote control for computers. Is that what you're alluding to? It doesn't really replace a remote control to remotely operate a computer. It can inject information into web servers. So any program that starts up a little web server on the side, you can invoke commands through it. But Team Viewer is not just a command type of a program. It's a kind of visual audio remote access type of thing. So, I mean, there would be no way to do it because you got yourself a little remote control with a small LED display. You couldn't cram a screen into it and make any sense of it. So it wouldn't be a practical use as Team Viewer.
Well, that answers my question.
Okay, Sam. Again, not every tool does everything that's possible to be done. The big problem is many years ago, I played around with programming, and I built this little program for my Amigas called RSL Clock. And it was a clock. It was a very nice clock. But I decided that it wasn't enough to be a clock. And I got into a Swiss Army knife type of thing with it, where when I was done, it had about 45 different functions. And, I realized that I kind of overdid it a bit. You know, if you have something that works well, that does five or six things, that's great. If you got something that does, 50, 60 things, you forget what they are and you don't use them and no one cares. At one point, I was always kind of upgrading and fixing and tweaking it. And one day, unfortunately, I my programming broke one of those things. And no one told me. I had to find it out by myself. So I realized that, they were using the other bits and pieces of it running. Too much of a good thing is, Swiss Army knives are nice, but, some of the more ridiculous versions that have, 150 different blades or attachments, it starts to get diminishing returns.
Any of these concepts patentable?
Say again, what about patentable?
You're creating these new concepts of controls. Is it something that's worthwhile to get a patent on?
Since I'm not writing, as far as if we're going back to the remote control device, it's just a couple of commands. I don't think you can really patent a web server commands. It's kind of baked into HTTP code.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Sam. Anyhow, anyone out there have any technical questions, amateur radio questions, science-related questions, or what have you?
Echo 2, Charlie Alpha Zero. I have a question.
Sure. What's your first name and what's your question?
My name is Edward, Echo Delta, Whiskey Alpha, Radio Delta, Edward here in North. And my question is, what is your thoughts on amateur TV in 2025? Back to you.
Okay. I haven't really played around with much of amateur radio TV. The closest that I have gone to is slow scan TV, which is a curious aspect of the hobby. What happens is people really, it's not multiple frame. It's just scanning single frames and reducing them to audio transmissions and using free encoder decoders to take the audio stream and create a screen image, and you can save the screen image. And I did that for a couple of times. I found that it was not, there weren't a lot of different hams doing it, because it seemed I was getting a small group of people sending it back and forth to each other. A lot of them, curiously, were Korean postcard images. There were some QSL cards, and there were some other images, and there were some cartoon frames, but a lot of Korean postcards for some strange reason. So that's my exposure to slow scan TV. There are other versions of amateur radio TV. They're more popular on the West Coast than the East Coast, because I think the West Coast just has a larger number of hams and a higher density. And you need a sort of high density, because a lot of amateur radio TV is irreducible to bandwidth. So you need a band that you can take up a very wide swath of bandwidth. And so that's why it ends up being a UHF type of transmission. And because of that, it's more line of sight. So you need a higher density so that people who can point their antennas at you and you can point them at them, or a repeater, I guess, but I've never seen a slow scan being used through some kind of repeater means, are the only people who could get your transmission. So if you... you know, Ham Nation every so often would cut to this one of the co-hosts on the West Coast, and you could see he was had a amateur radio TV screen up. But on the East Coast, it's very, very few and far between. I had a good friend, WA2CDL, who was very interested in it, but for lack of someone to play with. The person that he used amateur radio TV the most is now in his late 90s. He really doesn't get around much, so he couldn't do any more with him. And it's very difficult to find people on the East Coast, at least my experience in this area, interested in local faster scan type of amateur radio TV.
No, now I know why I couldn't find nobody into amateur TV radio here in New York City or in New Jersey. I have a question. My second question will be is, what is your thought on Linux getting involved in amateur radio operations? Linux as an operating system. Back to you.
Well, Linux has always been a tech guy's type of go-to operating system. I mean, unfortunately, there used to be command line mavens, you know, guys who could just type away obscure commands on the command line level before Linux had a GUI interface that you know, kind of made it a little less important to know command line codes. But I mean, I think since the very beginnings of Linux, it's been implemented in different amateur radio operations. So it's very common to find a lot of stuff that's Linux-based. I usually don't use Linux. I just find that I cobble together a lot of third-party software, and there's just enormously more Windows third-party than there are Linux. Or if they make them for Linux, they eventually make it for Windows. So I've kind of, unfortunately, not spent that much time. I've used it for Raspberry Pis. I have a bunch of Raspberry Pis, and you could download a whole bunch of amateur radio-related software and turn a little Raspberry Pi into an amateur radio server, you know, plug in an RTL dongle, and do all kinds of interesting things. So I think it's a done deal. It's been like this for a long, long time, and I think it will continue. Linux is, based on Unix originally. The kernel is based on it. It's a very sturdy kernel, and doesn't require rebooting like Windows tends to do. So I'm pro Linux, but I'm more of an observer other than for Raspberry Pis.
Roger. Thank you so much for letting me know. K2CAS listening.
The connection.
Say again? I missed that.
What is the relationship between Linux and Raspberry Pi?
One of the, because you can download a Linux operating system onto a Raspberry Pi, so it's a Linux box, as opposed to no one in their right mind yet has suggested that they could compress Windows into a Raspberry Pi operating system. So there's a few operating systems that you can install in a Raspberry Pi. The one that that most people do is a variety of Linux.
I haven't heard of any of this until I got the world clock, and that's where, if all of a sudden I'm being exposed to these words and systems.
Well, I mean, that's quite understandable. That's the basis of your world clock. Your world clock, as far as I'm aware, is a Raspberry Pi with an HDMI output, running some flavor of Linux, and running that software that was compiled to operate in your Raspberry Pi's Linux operating system environment. Linux is a favorite of makers. It's kind of considered a little bit overpriced at this point. People are looking to clones of Raspberry Pis. There are Orange Pis, and there's other Chinese knockoff boards. But in the old days when it first came out, it was next to no money at all. I have a device for my 3D printing, which I have on my list of toys that I've bought recently, that does modern-day 3D printing kind of has kind of strange little other things that you can do, and you can actually print out images and such. Originally, it was just changing the density of white plastic, so the absorption is different, and they're called lithophanes, so they're kind of shadow images. But nowadays, you can put layers of different color onto a 3D printed object and actually have a kind of three-dimensional full-color image. And one of the ways to kind of do that is to use an optical device to see what your pigment, what your filament's RGB color value is and how much it conducts light. And so I got a little light scanner that does that. And at the very bottom of the little teeny box that makes it run is a Raspberry Pi Zero, the kind of smallest, simplest version of a Raspberry Pi. It's about 1 square inch in surface area. And yet it boots up on RAM and runs this little program and tells me what I need to know.
New world.
Well, in many ways, yes. I've kind of mentioned repeatedly, probably tediously to some, that we kind of live in a golden age of technology. And human beings tend to think that things were always the way they are and always will be the way they are, but it's not. For short periods of time, yeah, but for long periods of time, no. The acceleration of understanding of technology is increasing every single day, not only with the artificial intelligence brouhaha and the billions of dollars that are being thrown back and sideways over it, but all the other fields of science and technology are booming, except possibly, unfortunately, battery technology is not kind of keeping pace with a lot of others. And, you know, rocket propulsion, unfortunately, isn't. Things that are kind of based on basic chemistry are not really taken off as fast as aspects that are related to physics, like solid-state electronics. But, you know, I mean, if you sleep late, you're going to miss some breakthrough in some technology. So, you know, we're living in exciting times for people who are interested in science and technology. You know, I mean, the Dark Ages, they didn't invent anything for hundreds of years almost. Anyway, once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So we're open for business. I hope we have a few other people with a few other topics for discussion or questions or what have you. I'm here if you're here.
H2NDP, I have some questions about, what I call a router. I forget what you call it. If no one else has questions, I could do that.
Okay, yeah, you probably, yeah, it's what I would probably call an access point. By the way, since you're here and Sam's here, I just want to tell people, unfortunately, we're not going to be doing the in-person meetings for a couple of months. Victor contacted the church, and there was some misunderstanding about the room that we were going to have access to. Doesn't have a Wi-Fi, and will not have Wi-Fi for at least 3 months. So we're back in Zoom-only land for the next 3 months.
Okay, good to know. Yeah, I was probably going to do Zoom anyway, but I was going to come there one of these days, but I always have this other Zoom at 7 on Wednesdays. Oh, anyway, I just ordered a link router. It's thing's called TP-Link Archer. It was recommended to me. But I'm just noticed I could have gotten, I got a model that costs like $80 from B&H. It's coming tomorrow. And I just noticed that the difference between that and the one that costs $30 more is mine has a 1 gig Ethernet only port configuration, whereas the other one comes with a 2.5 Ethernet WAN, WLAN, you know, connection. I'm wondering if that's important to someone like me, because I could easily send one back and order the other one.
Well, I guess the important thing is, what is your ISP provider giving you as far as bandwidth? My guess is a lot less.
I don't even know. I have, you know, I just don't know those. I just don't know. I guess I can look into it and find out. And why do I need an Ethernet? I guess, because there might be only one plug in my modem. So if I want to still use, just plug in directly with Ethernet. My computer's like 2 feet from my modem. That's where I have it. I'm getting this router for other reasons. So I might use it on the computer on some of the time. So I guess it's partly just so I can just plug into this router thing instead of having to have another plug in the back of the modem. Is that what it's for?
Well, it sort of depends what you're kind of asking about. If you're asking about the number of ports on your access point, usually more access point, ports is a good thing. So you can kind of use that as both an access point and as a hub, as a Ethernet switcher. You know, if you have, you know, there are some that just have one Ethernet port. You plug it into your router, your actual modem router, and that gives the Wi-Fi access to your Internet service provider. But if it has two or three or four or five ports, you can then use that as extra connections for your other Ethernet cables for your wired connections. If the question, which I thought it was the bandwidth, you know, if you have 1 gigabyte per second versus 10 gig or 2.5 gigabytes per second, chances are there's nothing going on at 2.5 gigabytes per second in your house. You know, unless you have some great fiber optic connection and you're paying a reasonable amount of money, probably if you don't know the speed, it's probably not even a gigabyte. So, or a gigabit per second. So whether or not you have a 2.5 or a 1.0 doesn't really make any difference for you. If you were some person who bought a massive bandwidth connection and you regularly stream 8K non-compressed video images, then you might want to have something a little bit bigger bandwidth.
Yeah, chances are, from what you're saying, chances are it doesn't matter to me. Yeah, I'm not a gamer. I don't know, maybe that's what one of those things that people might be using a lot, certain games, I'm guessing. I don't really know. Or, I mean, I watch an occasional on Netflix or something, but I don't even have the high-res thing for that. But and I don't watch things that often, actually. So you're probably right. It's probably, I'll check, but probably doesn't matter to me. The other thing, the brand is, I don't know if you know anything about this brand, it's just TP-Link Archer. It was recommended to me by some people, so I just, guys on B&H, so I got like $80. Supposedly it's normally $100, so it's coming tomorrow.
Yeah, I know TP-Link very well. And apparently the people that recommended it to you probably haven't been kind of listening to the technical news lately. There's been a big uproar about TP-Link is a Chinese mainland owned company. And it's sort of known, unfortunately, for its sloth when it comes to fixing points of entry. So there's been a lot of political and technical news lately about getting rid of TP-Link in the United States completely, because they feel it's a security danger. Now, if you're going to use it as a Wi-Fi access point, it's not going to be that dangerous. The problem is TP-Links also get used as routers, and their security is crap, and there's a lot of ways to break into a TP-Link router. So, you know, if you actually listen to technical news, you'll kind of, people will be talking derisively about TP-Link. Whether it makes that much difference as a wireless access point, I don't tend to think so. But I certainly would never buy it and use it as a router because of its security issues.
You don't know of any other access points, something in this price range or something like that? It supposedly has dual band, and these guys on this thing I have is this birding device, and it has to run on the lower speed, 2.4, but this guy, people say, oh, you can get these things that you can tell it to do the low band, then you can use the high band for something else if you want, the faster 5 gig. Anyway, this is supposedly one of the ones that could do that, but I'm sure there are tons of others.
Yeah, I mean, one of the major reasons why so many people have TP-Link devices, including me, but again, as 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi access points for a couple of my persnickety devices that really don't like my joined, you know, Wi-Fi 7 5.0 gigahertz / 2.4 gigahertz better Wi-Fi. They just can't manage it. They get confused by the 2.4 part of the band and such. But is the price. TP-Links are cheap. There are vaguely similar cheap, Asian manufacturers, I think D-Link, and there's a couple other name brands that are probably just as functional and have a somewhat better reputation as being a bit more secure than TP-Links are. But again, if you're not that worried about security issues and you're not going to use it as the front of your router, which I wouldn't suggest to do, if you hide it behind a more secure router, I don't think there's a lot that they could do with a TP-Link Wi-Fi access point.
By this other one that was people recommended, but it was something that cost like $300. Is that what you expect to pay for a really good, even just something that does two bands and you can do separate ones? I mean, do you have to spend that much?
No. If you want there's different standards. There's Wi-Fi 7, which is the latest, greatest, which I have in my Amazon-owned Eero mesh Wi-Fi system. But Wi-Fi 6 and Wi-Fi 5, there's a lot of older versions of Wi-Fi that have two bands. They've been using 5 gigahertz dual band access points for probably 8-9 years or more. So, I mean, you can get an older version that's half of that price or a third of that price. The more money you spend, the more bells and whistles, the latest, greatest algorithms. But again, you don't really need that. You're not running a major business out of your house. So, you just need something that works very simply. The less complicated it is, the less likely it'll get screwed up.
I want something I can set up easily. I mean, I feel like I'm reasonably competent in some technical things, but I never got it together with all this, like, protocols, internet protocols, modems. That stuff's all Greek to me, kind of. Well, this one that was recommended, it's called UBIQUITI. I looked it up, and these are things like $300. They look like big things with tons of range, where I have a 360 square foot, roughly, tiny apartment. I live alone, so I didn't think I needed range. Anyway, that's, have you ever heard that brand? I don't know how to say it. Ubiquiti or whatever.
It's pronounced Ubiquiti. It's a very popular techie Wi-Fi setup. It's incredible overkill for you. It's overpriced, but it's, you know, it's built like a tank, and it's got high-end technology, but it's kind of absurd. You know, I mean, again, if you're running some kind of a business where you know, you need to have things that are bulletproof and, you know, latest, greatest tech, so be it, but you'd be wasting your money. Very nice brand, very good equipment, but it's basically commercial equipment. You know, people usually don't require commercial equipment. They can get by with the consumer version of things.
That's what it looked like to me. It's like, oh, multiple users can use this. It has lots of range. It looked like a kind of a large thing, probably lots of ports and stuff. It was around the $300 price range, and there were probably ones that cost more than that. Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too. And someone else suggested this, you know, this other brand. It was this little forum about this bird device, which is one of those finicky devices that needs the lower speed. So that's what all this was about. But I wanted to also possibly have the capacity to run other things on the higher speed if I wanted to. Back to you.
Well, you know, it's not as simple as you know, 5 gigahertz means speed and 2.4 means slow speed or something. You know, 2.4 is very good. It has better range than 5 gigahertz. Something about with radios, we call that path loss. As you increase the frequency, you increase the attenuation for the same length of distance, and 2.4 is also used a lot for other purposes. Your Bluetooth is using 2.4. Your radar microwave is using 2.4, although hopefully it's shielded. So the 2.4 is not a bad band, but sometimes you need something that's less likely to get interfered with, even though its distance is shorter than a 2.4 signal. That's another problem with 2.4. Since it's a nice long signal, if you live in a congested area with other people that have 2.4 devices, you get collisions and you get problems getting your information across. So it's way more complicated than just fast or slow. But, you know, a lot of equipment, unfortunately, uses old Wi-Fi chips, and those Wi-Fi chips want to see 2.4. And even though the new chips will do 2.4, they have this tendency to try and convince devices to shift up to their 5 gigahertz band, even though they don't have a 5 gigahertz band. And it's those kind of interactions between more sophisticated Wi-Fi access points and older devices that cause a lot of problems. And a lot of this hardware has an option where you can turn off the 5 gigahertz for a while and, you know, let your device set up solely with the 2.4 gigahertz portion of that device, and then it'll kind of sneak in the 5 gigahertz, and hopefully it won't have problems. It won't realize that the 5 gigahertz is there, and it won't try to switch it back onto it.
I was reading stuff about that too. Like, yeah, the range is a two-edged sword. When you're in a, you know, I'm exactly one of those areas, because I don't use Wi-Fi, but if I forget to turn it off, if I was traveling and I had it on for being in somewhere else, and I see all these people's Wi-Fi, probably all my neighbors, you know, so obviously they would see mine. Supposedly, I read some reviews, or even this thing that I ordered, people say, oh, there's a way you can turn off, so they, I don't know how they do it, but so neighbors will not see your thing, supposedly, as somebody said in a review, and people also said you can make it so it makes two separate, you know, I see this, my aunt has this, I mean, they're two separate different, there's a 5 gig thing you see when you pull up the Wi-Fi options, and you see another one that's a 2.4, and you choose one or the other. You probably have different passwords and such things. So if that works, I guess that's the way to go.
Yeah, there's something called an SSID, and ordinarily the default for a Wi-Fi access point is it publishes their ID designation, and you can turn that off. It doesn't mean that your signals won't collide with your neighbors. It just means that there'll be no identifier. So if you call up a device and it says, you know, would you like to connect to a local Wi-Fi, it won't have that name. So you'll have to remember, you know, I set it up with the name Bob's Place, but it's not showing up because I blocked its SSID function. So you have to manually put in the ID, you know, Bob's Place, and then the password, and then it will use that to connect and pair with the Wi-Fi. So, but that's just the identifier. And some Wi-Fi access points were designed that way, where the two bands had two different IDs. So you could pair with the 5 gigahertz or the 2.4 gigahertz. Modern ones tend to kind of go for a mesh where everything has the same SSID, has the same name, and as you, theoretically, as you travel from one portion of your estate to another, it will disconnect from one mesh and reconnect to a closer mesh to give you a better signal. They still haven't quite figured that out completely.
Where I live, I don't think I need that with my... I think it could never be more than maybe 15 feet away. It might be through a wall, but hoping that is probably good enough for most of those technologies. Yeah, my aunt, at my aunt's house, I mean, and they probably had the same modem for over 10 years, I'm guessing. Yeah, there's two different choices, a slower, the 2.4 or a 5.
Yeah. I think my old router had that option for the Wi-Fi. I had one for 2.4, and I had a name for the 5. So that worked out that way. But it depends upon what you need. Not everyone needs the same thing. I was kind of being a little facetious when I said your estate, because basically meshes are extreme overkill unless you have a big white house. My house is about 50 feet from end to end, and there's a backyard. And so, sometimes it gets a little dicey, and then there's a basement. So I have three mesh Wi-Fi access points, two on my floor and one in the basement. And I had some extra one, and I turned it on in my kitchen, and I screwed up all my Wi-Fis. It was jamming the hell out of everything and everyone. So, I tried to kind of fix it, and I finally gave up and turned it off, and everything started to work again. So, like all things, too much of a good thing isn't a good thing.
Right. So I guess, I could probably watch a Netflix movie or something on my, with a 2.4 even, right?
Yes, you could. Assuming that you don't have a lot of interference or something else going wrong, the amount of data that you need for the non-high resolution Netflix can easily be handled by a 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi connection.
Okay, and one other question. Well, actually, I'm thinking of getting I want to get a monitor because I was using an old iMac that functionally wasn't working as a computer anymore. Well, a hard drive crashed in a funny way, not losing data, but it couldn't boot anymore. But I was using it as an external monitor to my laptop. Now I've got a new Mac laptop, and it's not compatible anymore. So I'm going to get rid of it and buy a monitor. I'm thinking of buying a pretty high, maybe a 4K one for photo editing. So I guess all of a sudden I might be tempted to do high res movies, and then I probably need more. Well, this is probably moot because I'll probably just plug in the way I do now just directly. So it probably won't matter. But in that case, I might need a faster, or maybe not, 5 gigahertz connection if I was going to go that way.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it. You're not going to kind of walk around with your monitor and need a wireless access point for it. Like you said, you're probably much better off just plugging an Ethernet cable and not worrying about anything at all. 4K is sort of okay. It's a high resolution. I haven't gotten around to 4K yet, and I kind of used to joke on the Limark TechNet about how they announced announced 8K, and soon they're going to announce 16K, and you know it's starting to get somewhat absurd. As far as a good monitor for you, I would aim a little less at the resolution and a little bit more at the color gamut and fidelity. Because that's really the most important thing when it comes to computer, you know, checking out images and photographs and such. You don't necessarily gain that much, I don't think, from a 4K display as opposed to one that has a more sophisticated color chemistry and a wider gamut.
Yeah, I want to do more research on all this. I mean, I'm starting to read these things. You know, this one monitor was suggested by, and this is a photography forum. I mean, these are bird and wildlife photographers, which I'm doing a lot of that as a hobby, birds in my case mostly. And it's, you know, it's what I do a bunch of pixel PB, like, but I guess one thing is 4K, it's going to be higher resolution, so when you blow it up 100%, it's not as big. It's smaller. Everything's smaller, too. So, yeah, I'm going to do more research before I buy one, but I was wondering about was all good to have higher resolution.
Yeah, well, again, it sort of depends upon what you're really looking for. If you, you know, if you want to see films and such which are made to be displayed on 4K, yeah, I guess so. But I mean, if you're just looking at photographs and such, you know, I mean, again, it could be a little case of overkill. You're not going to really, at least I haven't noticed any pixelation you using a 2K monitor. Anything, you know, like, you know, I think my monitors are 1,600 lines deep. And, you know, I don't see any pixelation whatsoever. So, you know, but then my eyes are kind of semi-shot. So, you know, I mean, if you got the money, yeah, sure. But if you don't have the money, if I had the choice between, say, a very, very good wide color gamut, accurate display that's 2K versus a generic 4K, I would probably go for the 2K.
But I guess if it had both the color gamut and the resolution, well, then it, of course, makes it more expensive, but I guess some people would argue that that's the best.
Well, yeah, I mean, that would be the best, but I mean, that would be the most expensive. That way you'd be paying $20,000, $30,000, which is kind of, I think, out of most of our budget. So, yeah, I mean, you could get the best, most professional monitor made presently, and then you basically have no money left. So, you know, everything's a compromise in life, amateur radio and all the other things. So, yeah, ultimately, is it worth it to you, the wide gamut? You know, again, if you make a lot of money in photography and color reproduction is incredibly important, you can rationalize it. If you just kind of need to have a reasonable facsimile of what the image looks like, then you don't have to get a professionally made and overpriced monitor.
I mean, I wasn't thinking about $20,000, $30,000, but I was looking at these things around the $1,500 price range. So I get something at 4K, but maybe in that price range or even under that or whatever, I guess, is it sort of like you could spend that on getting one or the other? Is that kind of what you're saying, wide color gamut without the high res or the other way around? Or is it? That sounds too simple, but what's your thought on that?
Well, I mean, all things being equal, for the same amount of money, usually, unless you happen upon a great deal, you have a choice. Either the color is going to be better at the lower resolution for the same price. So, you know, you're either buying a high resolution, which, again, is nice, but it's not as important as good reproduction of the color range that you're trying to visualize. So, you know, most professional guys, when they're buying monitors, will end up wanting both. And if they can't afford both, I would assume that they would err on the side of the better color resolution as opposed to just the pixel. pixel numbers, because pixel numbers are just pixel numbers. It doesn't really, you could have a beautiful reproduction with 4K. You could have a crap monitor with crappy reproductions that's 4K. So they're not kind of intrinsically coupled with each other is the problem.
Right, and even the higher resolution, sometimes, like I even noticed on my, I have a 16-inch MacBook Pro, relatively new, and the model is actually about a year old. I bought it new, though. But, you know, it was expensive, and it's got a pretty high-res screen for a 16-inch. It's like the across number is 1,700 and something. And one thing I noticed when I take a photo of a bird, and you always look to see if there, is it really sharp, and go for the eye. And, you know, it's got a 100%, and it's not that big. So it's going to be smaller. So in some ways, the lower res, I want to see it bigger. And in some ways, I could see better, maybe, how sharp it is. Sometimes on this thing, I'll go to 200. And I have to remind myself, yeah, it doesn't look as good. Well, yeah, because I'm doing 200. So it doesn't mean I'm used to looking at us. You know what I'm saying. Anyway, lower resolution is going to be bigger when you do that same 100%, zoom in thing. Back to you.
AC2GS. Yeah, you're talking about dots per inch. You know, I mean, what is it? iPhones are something like 300 dots per inch, and images can be printed out in terms of dot per inches and such. So you could have a very, very, very high resolution image, but if the screen is relatively small for the massive resolution, everything's teeny tiny. That was one of the big problems with Windows for years and years. It still has problems scaling correctly. So a lot of times people will get themselves an ultra high resolution laptop and they can't see anything. Everything is little teeny tiny print, and some things they can scale up, but some things they can't scale up. So it's a software limitation, but what you're talking about is dots per inch on any kind of display technology.
Right, so, but also when you blow up the bird, you know, like sometimes you want to see it a little bigger on a bigger screen. So what I'm getting is a 27-inch monitor, which is the same size as this iMac that I'm going to have to get rid of. What I'm used to, and it's plenty big for me, and so I got more research to do, and I'll be reading this photography forums, and a lot of them will be probably saying some of the same things you said and about color. Yeah, so but thanks for that. That gives me a much clearer, some things I was thinking maybe that was the case, and I was nice to get some confirmations from you and things that were just new to me too. So yeah, great, thanks. And so you think I'd basically probably be okay with this TP-Link, whatever you call it. And I'm just using the router modem that comes with, who am I with? Spectrum. It's just their thing. Yeah. Back to you.
Yeah, I think as long as you keep it behind your firewall that your actual ISP's router provides, it shouldn't be that problematic. I would not use TP-Link as a router, as a direct connection to your to whatever you plug directly into your ISP cable that comes into the house. But you know, I mean, there's still noise out there. There's still people talking about, you know, although it's kind of more quiet now that TikTok is kind of been diffused, that they wanted to do a similar job with TP-Link and just prohibit sales in the United States because of security issues.
You know, I might get some. So what if I just, like, if it was a case where I think there's only one, like, jack or plug in the back of the my router from Spectrum, I might have to have the other thing, this TP-Link, plugged into it. I'd have to plug through TP-Link just to have a direct Ethernet connection without pulling plugs out. That's what I was thinking. Is that a security risk? If it, you know, would that make it a different situation for that?
No. switches are switches are switches. Anything that you plug into any switch is the same, no matter which switch you plug it into. So the point is that the most insecure aspect of TP-Link routers is that they're kind of pointed outward into the internet itself through your internet service provider. And there are many different novel ways that you can manipulate that connection and gain access to the router. And through gaining access to the router, it can sniff around and find all of the intranet private IP addresses that might be on the other side of the router. But if you put the TP-Link past the router, there's no kind of simple way for hackers to kind of get into that, because they have to go through the actual non-TP-Link router that has a firewall that's supposed to protect, hopefully, these ports from being played with. So, you know, you could use it as a switch. That's not going to be a problem. And, you know, it doesn't matter the topology of which switch is connected to which device. Once you have something connected to your router, it's all one big Ethernet connection.
Right, that kind of makes sense to me. I just kind of double checking. Makes sense. Yeah, okay. So maybe I'll just use this thing, maybe I'll poke around, and if I feel uncomfortable, I got a 30-day return. You know, V&H has that, so I could pick up something else. But yeah, I'll check it out, and I'll just see how easy it is to set up, because I've never had one of these things. I've always just used direct connection, so we'll see if it's a pain to set up or not. So I'll find that stuff out too. Maybe I'll be asking more questions a couple weeks from now.
Sure, anytime. But it shouldn't be that difficult. I mean, pretty much all that it really needs to ask you is, what do you want to name your access point? So it has an SSID. And what you want the password to be to the security access. It'll probably implement a WAPA 2, which is decent. And it'll just set it up. You could go in and go into the web server page, and you could tweak it and adjust it. You could change the name if you want. You could turn off SSID broadcasting. So, you know, but, you know, if you don't want to, it'll work without tweaking it in different ways. Most of these things have a kind of a simplified little brochure, tells you to kind of connect it and turn it on, and go to a certain address and just answer its questions, and then it just kind of works. You might have a little problem getting access to it, because you just have to type in the right address on your browser. And, you know, some of them are a little bit easier to get to than others. Shouldn't be that big a problem.
Most reviewers said it was pretty easy to set up. There's always a few people that say the opposite. That always happens. But yeah, they were saying, yeah, it's just a very brief brochure, but I'll look at it, you know, go to some website or maybe, I think they might even have an app, and that's where you do this stuff. And I can even read these reviews, but I'll probably find out enough. It'll probably send me to some web address, and then I can read more detailed stuff there. I think it should be okay. We'll find out. I'm supposed to get it tomorrow, and I'll have some time to mess with it over the weekend, I think.
I always use YouTube when I don't know something.
Well, I mean, Sam, that's a good resource. Sometimes you can kind of get the wrong idea. For some strange reason, every so often, there's some guy who gets it incredibly wrong in YouTube. Unfortunately, I find that's a little bit more common when it's amateur radio related. There's a lot of Bubbermeister, grandmother tales and such that are kept alive on YouTube that shouldn't. But, caveat emptor and learner enter. Let the learner beware. But YouTube's good. But you still need a little bit of a well-calibrated BS meter. Well, I wish you good luck with this, Bob. And, of course, if you have any questions, feel free to ask me. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're still open for business. We basically don't have a closing time. We close when people don't have anything to talk about. So, with that in mind, if anyone has any questions or comments or topics that they would like to discuss tonight, please hit that push to talk.
Hey, Roy, this is KD2VEA.
Hello, Maxim.
All right, then. Yeah, I'm just doing a little bit late night work, so I'm on Echolink. I'm not right in my rig over there. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your Echolink setup. With thinking about that radio that's running around and doing not much work on the digital radio, giving it the wireless access. I don't know how useful that is, but Echolink notes might be valuable, more valuable than the digital kind. I just wanted to learn a little bit more about your setup, and then also ask you if you have any, if you think we should set up a second node on that radio, or if that's not really useful or valuable in your opinion.
I'm not quite sure if that's possible. You might want to do some Googling, because I would think that there's some connection to the Wires X module from the from the radio that would collide completely with an implementation of Echolink, because you need audio in and audio out. You got to feed it to a soundboard and then into a computer that's running a server version of Echolink, and use those two, the virtual audio input and outputs at the very least. You need a tube pair if you want to actually have someone talk through it locally. But you would need a computer. You would need a server version of Echolink, which is free. You would need some kind of USB connection for the computer to offer input and output. And I would think that this would collide with the requirements for using the same radio for Wires X.
Well, then I was thinking really instead of the Wires X, because nobody's really using Wires X. But you're assuming that that's, let's say nobody wants Wires X and we can substitute one the other. Is there really any value in having two access points, yours and that one? Or not?
Well, I'm trying to think to myself. The only thing I can think of is, you know, in case you like redundancy. So, you know, if something happens, if my computer blows up, then you could switch it over to the other system. The only problem that might happen is it's probably not that big a problem with your version of the radio with the Wires X and everything. I have a lot of audio devices, and so invariably, every so often, for no apparent reason, Echolink likes to just change the virtual audio cable links to something random. And so it no longer is connected to the radio. So I've gotten into the unfortunate habit of at least once a day checking to see, you know, what audio devices Echolink is using. So I guess theoretically, if you have a good remote link in and you can kind of do stuff like that, it shouldn't be a problem. But I think it's more of a kind of redundancy, you know, in case of failure, you have a fallback. But you'd have to kind of manually, as far as I can conceive, implement it, because you know, otherwise, you know, it would kind of confuse everything and you'd get echoes and such.
Got it. So what I'm getting out of you is not that don't waste your time. That's what I think I'm getting.
Well, I mean, not necessarily. I mean, we've talked before about contingency plans. I think it's always good to have contingency plans. So if you kind of have the interest to try and do that, and you can kind of set one up just to kind of sit in the background and be summoned on demand, I think that's a plus.
Very interesting. So in other words, you're able to monitor a frequency all the time.
Yeah, you can. I mean, I generally do. I mean, I'm monitoring this repeater. I generally, historically, monitor Limark's repeater. And I've had other repeaters that I have the ability to record on a Vox setting 8 different channels of audio on my computer. I can hook up my Flex radio, which is capable of 8 virtual receivers, and simultaneously record 8 frequencies using Vox.
That's incredible. That's really incredible.
Well, you know, I like to play with things. I like to figure out things, and it's kind of weird. Limark has this very weird system that supposedly, I hope they've changed it by now, but I doubt, only records something like 30-second snippets of audio and emails it to the guy who is supposed to be running the repeater. So if he ever needs to reconstruct audio on the repeater, he has to merge together hundreds and hundreds of emailed files. Usually in the past, when people heard about what I was doing at Limark, you know, they'd email me or they'd call me up and they say, you know, last Wednesday at 2 o'clock, some guy did something wrong. Can you pull the tape and send it to me? And since I got my stuff time stamped also, it's not that difficult. But, you know, I like to kind of, you know, press the edges of the bleeding edge here.
What the CIA has going.
Yeah, the CIA, but more important, probably the NSA. I think the NSA has invested a lot of money in the same company that my radio is from, Flex Radio. They do sophisticated software-defined radios, and whereas the consumer version is only capable of 8 simultaneous virtual receivers, I'm willing to bet you that the NSA have versions that are capable of many, many, many more virtual receivers simultaneously.
Frankly, I never knew such systems existed at our level.
Well, you got to keep your eyes open. My Flex 6700 has been around for about 11 years, maybe more. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, I don't know, the company has a new 8000 series, and they haven't replaced the 6700. The 6700, they have a couple of them in stock that they are willing to sell, but they're not really manufacturing, say, an 8700, which would be like mine. So maybe there just aren't that many people interested. You know, I mean, when I bought it and I started to use it, you know, there were some people, there's always some people who said, you know, what do you need 8 channels for? How are you going to listen to 8 different conversations at the same time? Well, you don't necessarily have to do that. You could record them and you could kind of go through them rather quickly and figure out whether they're anything interesting or not. Or, you know, with the Flex, I'm able to adjust the passband. So I can vary the passband from 3 kilohertz, which is what you'd want for a single sideband, to 196. And if you do it on the CW end of the band, 196 kilohertz, you could feed it into an automated thing called CW sweep and see, you know, 20, 30, 40 guys sending CW simultaneously on that band within that 196 kilohertz.
I appreciate the introduction to the concept of Flex Radio, because you told me that's what your rig was, and I was just thinking that you were using a very advanced rig, not realizing what it was capable of.
Yeah, it's like I said, they make much fancier stuff for the government. I think most of their profits are government contracts. I remember, you know, Dick Nadel, K2RIW, was the host of the Limark Technical Net. And we used to kind of chat about it, and you know, I don't think he kind of kept up with the state of the art of silicon. He was an RF guy, and he kind of thought that if my radio had the specs that I told him he did, it should have melted down from the waste heat. Which obviously it didn't.
Really amazing.
Yeah. Occasionally it's good to be on the bleeding edge. Sometimes it can give you a bit of agita. But, you know, I mean, you gotta kind of deal with the good and the bad.
A question about CB.
Okay, that's not particularly my expertise, but you could ask.
A lot of hams are interested in the CB area, which I find weird. I mean, when I was younger, a younger ham, about 40 years ago, you looked down on CBers and you felt like, I'm in ham radio, CBers are not, not real radio people. And yet today I hear a lot of discussions about CB radio by ham radio operators, and I'm just sort of surprised if there's been a change in the interest in CB by ham radio operators.
I don't think there's been a great change. What happened, I think the situation is that when you got into the hobby, there were sort of two major branches of people who got into amateur radio. Those were shortwave listeners, and the other were guys mustering out of the armed forces from the Signal Corps. So they kind of got a taste for radio, and it wasn't particularly their profession per se, and they just kind of gravitated to the amateur radio version. And I was a shortwave listener, and I listened to a lot of stations. I particularly listened to a lot of amateur radio stations, and I was entertained by their conversation, and that kind of ignited the light. So in that time frame, most people came from those two branches. A few years later on, you started to get a third branch, which were people who began as CBers, either from relatives or terrible country movies, and they evolved from CB into amateur radio. I think those people, some of them think more kindly of CB and treat it better than shortwave listeners and Signal Corps people who kind of looked at them as pretty much outlaws. I listen into the CB bands when I do the 10-meter net because I used to have a guy who jammed me because, and of course, he came from CB land. I don't know. They all sound like shock jocks, or they have this deep Caribbean voice or something. It's kind of like there's only two guys on the CB that got cloned, and they're all over the darn place. And I've never been particularly entertained by anything any of those guys have said. So I tend to have the attitude of a shortwave listener, as opposed to, again, guys who grew up being CBers, remember their names, their handles, their 10 codes, and all kinds of things. And they look back longingly at their childhoods and such. So that's my two cents worth on it.
Thank you for sharing. I too was a shortwave listener and got involved. And of course, there was the CW portion, and a lot of them didn't have any interest in learning CW, and therefore they just stayed away from the hobby of ham radio as a result, which I think is a
Yeah, I mean, CBers, unfortunately, they tended to be younger. They tended to be immature because they were younger, and they tended to cut a lot of corners. There was a lot of breaking of rules. FCC 97 didn't apply to them. They used amplifiers when they weren't supposed to, and they didn't particularly care if they were dirty amplifiers. As a matter of fact, they discovered that if they overdrive a linear amplifier into nonlinearity, the output signal is more watts, and they were much more interested in the number of watts in the meter than the fact that they were spewing harmonics all over the place.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you could still see those type of guys. They have YouTubes. There are guys who specifically fix CB equipment and talk about cutting corners, and they take a certain pleasure in breaking rules. Unfortunately, it's never been my style, so I never really thought of CB. But, I had friends, wonderful, brilliant technicians who came up through the CB channel. And, it didn't screw around with them. So, you could come in from CB and be as good a ham as anyone else could be.
I also heard conversation recently about tubes, that using the tubes in their equipment. I haven't seen tubes in anything, and yet I hear that they still have, amplifiers that are using tubes that cost $1,000 a piece or something. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, those are ceramic tubes. Ceramic tubes can run you $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 CZ or something. Very powerful. You can run 2 kilowatts. And a linear amplifier tube, a vacuum tube-driven linear amplifiers are still popular in amateur radio. I happen to have a solid-state one because I don't need something that produces a lot of heat and requires a dedicated outlet. I have my Expert Systems solid-state linear amplifier. It can run as much as 1.3 kilowatts on a 120-volt utility socket that's not dedicated. So there are other circuit, there are other devices on that circuit, and it doesn't dim the lights or anything. So I prefer solid state. But a lot of people I know have vacuum tube based. MFJ sold tons of them.
I was really surprised to hear people talking about getting tubes in the first place at this point in time. I thought that everything is solid state at this point.
No, like I said, a lot of people have old radios that had tubes originally, and they're replacing them. But for the most part, most of the tubes that I tend to hear about on amateur radio are in people's linear amplifiers. It's incredibly common. I would consider that probably three-quarters, maybe three-fifths, of the linear amplifiers out there owned by hams are vacuum tube based because they're cheaper, at least at this point. As time goes on, I think silicon will get cheaper and there'll be much more solid state. But you tell a ham that they could get an MFJ vacuum tube based linear amplifier for $1,400 or a solid state for $3,500, a lot of hams will go with the vacuum tube.
They say, copy that.
Well, it's ultimately, I make a joke that amateur radio operators tend to be real tight with the money. There's a couple of show-offs out there. I remember a guy who passed away who didn't even remember the model of radio he had. He just described it as the most expensive one that ICOM sells. So, but he was always, in my mind, the exception to the rule. Most hams, they're looking for good value, and they're really looking for a bargain. I understand it. So again, that's why vacuum tubes will probably persist for many, many years. Until the price of the LDMOS solid state power modules drop dramatically in price, it'll be a bargain someday, maybe.
Okay. Thank you very much for your analysis of what's going on in this area. I appreciate that. Right now, I'm focusing on antenna. I've got to improve my antenna system. I have a wire running around the roof of my house, and I got to do something better than that.
Yeah, antennas is the one big variable that amateur radio operators tend to focus on. Almost no one has the expertise to design radio receivers, transmitters. They might be able to do a antenna tuner, but would probably rather not. So the most creative aspect of the hobby right now is antenna design, because it can range from something as simple as a bunch of pieces of wire and some mechanical support for the structure. And it could go into more esoteric of aluminum tubes and radials and stubs and all kinds of interesting little add-ons. And there's a big ARRL handbook of antenna that discusses hundreds and hundreds of different models of antennas. And, that's where the creativity really lies. And even if you accomplish something, there's always the next antenna that you want to try. So I wish you good luck. We've talked about this in the past, that the unfortunate limitation that I had no clue about was the mechanical aspects of getting something on the roof if I couldn't do it by myself. And I just don't come from a long line of people who don't like to use ladders too much. So that has been a handicap through the years. But, you know, the way that amateur radio operators often demonstrate their technical creativity is in coming up with an antenna design that suits their location. They're all compromises, you know, unless you have, you know, 20 acres of land someplace and you can put up towers and all kinds of stuff. Almost no one can do that. So it's all going to be a compromise in one way or another.
I mentioned this already to you, but I bought a 6-foot tower to be assembled, and I bought the more expensive hex antenna, and all the parts are lying around in the living room. I'm waiting to get spring, and I'm waiting to find somebody who's going to go up there and stick it together.
Yeah, hex beams are interesting devices. Someone really urged it on me way back. I eventually went with fan dipoles because it gave me resonance on all the bands simultaneously. The problem as I see hex beams is that you kind of give up 40 and 80. It's really designed for 20 and above. So if you don't mind giving up 40 and 80, then it's a good, somewhat directional antenna design.
What I have, of course, was to keep the wire running around the roof and then put the hex in addition and just get a switch and let that be the system that would most fit the top of a brownstone in Brooklyn and get away with it, you know, with the limitation of the square footage of the roof.
Yeah, I mean that's a good plan. I had two HF antennas once upon a time. I had my fan dipole, which was sort of my main one, and for some good reason, I decided that I should put up some 10-meter antennas specifically just in case. And I was able to hook one of my 6700 flex input into one of the antennas, and the other antenna into the other input of that receiver, and I could listen to the horizontally polarized antenna with one ear and the vertical in the other ear. And I actually heard some guy in Florida that most of the time I would think was fading in and fading out, but he wasn't. His polarization angle was rotating in time. So I heard him in the right ear, then I heard him in the left ear, and I heard him in the right ear, and it just kept on going on and on and on. So diversity reception, they call that. So it's very nice to have more than one antenna, just in case.
That's very funny. What is a fan dipole?
Okay, fan dipole is basically, you can think of it as a bunch of parallel vertical center-fed dipoles that where the separate wires have a common center antenna feed, and the separate dipoles are spread a little bit apart by some wooden or plastic insulating material. So you have a series of different parallel center-fed dipoles that are cut to different lengths. When you transmit on, say, 20 meters, it will go up to the feed line, and because they're at different lengths, they present with different impedances. And the one that's built for that frequency is going to have an impedance around 50 ohms, and preferentially, most of the radio energy is going to go into that leg of the dipole. Then if you change to, say, 40 meters, it'll select for a different leg of the dipole, because at 40 meters, that the original dipole is now reading too high an impedance. The 40-meter cut leg is going to show the 50 ohm impedance and going to transfer the energy there.
Into your antenna tuner?
Well, if you do it right, you may not even need an antenna tuner. That's the pleasure of it. Antenna tuners are nice, but you pay a price. It causes a significant amount of attenuation loss depending upon the amount of adjustment you have to make at the shack, unless you have your antenna tuner at the antenna feed point and have it, have it shielded from the weather and such. But all things being equal, most of my fan dipole did not need much tweaking with an antenna tuner. At 80 meters, it had a very high Q and a very narrow bandwidth and needed it a lot. But higher up, not so much if you tune it right.
Progress with my knowledge of ham radio, because I'm starting to really understand what you're talking about. I'm making progress, Roy. I'm making progress.
Great. I mean, that's the point of the exercise. I learn from these technical nets as well. I hope everyone does. Sometimes I get a little too esoteric for some people. Sometimes I get a little too simple for some people. But, I hope it kind of evens out at the end.
The wisdom is welcome.
It's my pleasure, Sam. That's what I'm here. Although the reason that I actually do have a tech net here is because of a guy who used to stroll in, I think, about once a year, and every year he had a brilliant idea for a job for me to do. And the concept at the time was that I thought some people were a little too intimidated with Dick, K2RIW, because, I knew people who, he was a very smart guy. So a lot of times people were afraid to get on to the Limewark technical net because they didn't want to sound stupid or anything. So the idea, I think, at the time for me was, well, no one's going to be intimidated by me. So this is an alternative, if you're afraid of Dick, you shouldn't be afraid of me. That's how we started it off many years ago.
I can tell you that I'm glad that I'm tuned in, and it's very interesting. I'm into the photography, I'm into the Wi-Fi, I'm into so many different topics that were touched on this evening, and it's part of having what's known as a scientific mind or a curiosity about life and what goes on. So this is really a very interesting net that you have running here.
Well, thank you, Sam. I've always been curious scientifically, much to the annoyance of family members. I tell people this story, so I might as well tell you. When I was about 7 years old, and I was walking back, my father, may he rest in peace, went over to Sheepshead Bay. He had a friend who owned a candy shop, and he would go and kibitz with him and talk about the old days on the east side, and then we'd stroll back, and he'd mentioned that that guy happened to work for Murder Incorporated. And you can imagine what a seven-year-old thought of that. And I remember when we got on our block, I looked up at the sky and I said, "I wonder why the sky is blue." And God bless my father, said, Why do you ask stupid questions?" So, and I've been asking stupid questions ever since.
Do you have time for a hamster story?
Sure.
I guess I was about 8 years old. I bought a hamster, and a day later it got loose, and I didn't want my parents to know about it, so I bought another hamster. And a couple of days later, my mom said to me, "A hamster had babies."
That's a good one. I never had a hamster. I had a turtle. That poor turtle. I think it lasted about 2 weeks. And, I came over to the tray there, and it was inside, and I tapped on it, and I gave it a little water, and I gave it a little food, and it never came out. So, I haven't been terribly lucky with pets. I developed an interest in freshwater tropical fish for 7-8 years. I did reasonably well. They died in the end, but then everything dies at the end. But it was more successful than my poor turtle.
A 20-gallon tank going right now, and no one's died in the past year.
Well, you're a very fortunate man. I mean, I've had fish that committed suicide. I've woken up to find a fish swimming against the flow in a siphon tube. I found them on the floor. I've had apparently fish that had some psychological problems or depressions or something weird.
It was a fish doctor. Anyway, that's cool, man. Very cool. Anyway, I knew that the scientific interest that you had would be a mesh for my scientific interest as well. I'm going to say 73. I'm watching a very good show on Apple TV, and I want to get back and see who lives and who dies in it. So I'm going to say 73 and tell you how much I enjoyed the net tonight.
Yeah, thank you, Sam. I appreciate your participation, and I hope you enjoy the rest of that show.
73 to the net.
Okay, once again, I'm AC2GS, and like I said before, we don't close until, you know, people run out of things to ask or talk about. So I leave it up to the audience. I'm here. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, I'd be more than willing to stick around. So this is AC2GS.
UNVB, I have another question. I think this thing is not what I want, but I can bounce it off of you, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay, this is another thing on B&H's Ubiquity Networks Cloud Gateway Ultra. That's not the same thing, is it? That's just looks like something for routing lots of devices, you know, in your own office or something. Is that true, or could it also be what I need? Because it's not that expensive. It's $129.
Well, I mean, it's hard to tell because that's just kind of a brand name type of thing. But I would assume it's just a firewall router, you know, where, you know, you get on a web server and you can tweak connections. You could block, you know, some IP address in your house from getting to different places. You can set it on a timer. So if you have little kids and they're supposed to go to sleep by 10 o'clock, but, you know, they're screwing around, you could have the device cut their external internet access at that time and reestablish it at 7 o'clock in the morning and things like that. But again, that's conjecture. I don't specifically, I'm not familiar with all of Ubiquity's brand names and what the different brand names mean.
You're right. I suspected that. I mean, it has stuff like redundant WAN with failover and load balancing, monitoring devices. You know, it sounds like an internal kind of network of stuff, like before you go out to the internet, and you probably hook your other stuff to it. Yeah, that's what it is. Because you would be using that in addition to what I have if I was a lot of people in an office or something like that.
Yeah, I think Ubiquity is primarily well known for their commercial products, and you know there's always guys out there who need the best. So even if it's overkill, it's a good brand name, and they're built sturdy, and you know they get props for it. So they go with Ubiquity. It's overkill. You don't need redundancy. You don't have a redundant system. You don't have two ISP providers that allow you to have kind of emergency fall over from one ISP to another ISP in case the world comes to an end. You just have your cable TV connection. That's all.
Too bad they don't. Well, maybe they do. I don't know. I haven't found it yet. If they make something more tailored to someone like me, but it's just well made, and you know, I'd pay twice what this thing I just got. I'd pay $150 or something if it was really just what I needed, but a secure, robust version. You know, maybe they do. I don't know. All right, so I'll just poke around, or I'll just deal with this thing I'm getting tomorrow, and I might just leave it at that. Well, thanks a lot for your help, Roy, and see if anyone else is out there or has any questions.
Yeah, you're welcome, Bob, anytime. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, and we're still open for business if there's any business to be had. So if anyone has any questions, comments, or topics tonight, please hit that push to talk now before I run away.
Hey, Roy, this is KD2VEA. Just going to say I'm running away. It's time for bed. It's been a long enough day, but thanks for answering my questions. Always good to hear you. And if you're bored on Saturday and want to freeze your butt off, why don't you come join us at the Prospect Park if you want to.
I wish you all the luck in the world. I keep looking at the temperature for Saturday. I wish it had the weather report that it has for Sunday. It's my little indicator here says a high of 34, a low of 29. So dress warm. Everyone out there is going to go to the winter field day. Dress incredibly warm. Hope you have loads of fun.
UNVP with a analysis of some of the other voices and how they're sounding will help you troubleshooting your issue. Max has the same issue as you do coming through my radio, so maybe it's the repeater. Although the other station that was talking with you for so long did not. He sounded normal. But Max is just like you. It's like this weird low distortion thing.
Okay, he's coming through Echolink, and Sam was through the radio. So it could be my radio. I don't know. I'm receiving reasonably well, but, you know, that doesn't mean anything. It could be something funky with the transmitter. I do not know.
Okay, but I guess I just fed you a little more data. Maybe you'll figure it out, hopefully. And I'd be interested in finding out what it is. Next time you do a net or whatever, you know, you'll probably have figured it out. I'm curious. Back to you, Roy.
Well, I mean, ultimately, it depends on what's causing it. If it's the transmitter, it's kind of difficult for me to suss it out locally. I'd need to have some other person with an antenna listening to the output of the radio. And I tell you what, we'll try a very, very simple one. I'll go directly into the radio. So my microphone, without the Echolink, without the electronics and such, because theoretically it could be anything from the sound board to the radio's audio input to the radio. So stand by for a sec.
It was passed. You passed the test. That was absolutely normal.
Okay, so the good thing is it's probably not the transmitter of the radio. It's probably some portion of the sound going around. And now the problem is that, you know, we talked earlier about Linux and Windows being such crap. There are some times that I boot up my computer and almost everything works beautifully and one or two things doesn't work right. And I reboot and it works right. So it's within the realm of possibility that if I could instantaneously reboot my computer, it might not sound that bad. But unfortunately, because so many things have to start up to get everything working, it's a good 10, 15 minutes. So I'm not disposed to do things like that unless I have no choice. So it'll be interesting to see. Now, the big question is to ask the people, I assume there are people who were listening to the InfoNet Tuesday, and some of them went through Echolink. So the big question for me is, what was the audio quality of the people talking through Echolink yesterday? Because I rebooted the computer. So if it's just a reboot of the computer, it would be more likely that yesterday's Echolink audio was fine.
Okay, maybe, just maybe, somebody, well, if they might not be listening today, the meeting is next week. Just bring it up on the off chance that somebody was on and remembers. Oh, they'd probably remember if it was like that, if it was weird, if it was. Yeah, maybe you can find out.
Well, it's not going to be next week. The general meeting is in 2 weeks because it's one of those things where there's five Wednesdays. I would assume not, because William sent me some kind of strange emails that he was having problems getting onto the Echolink, but then he got onto the Echolink, and I would assume that if the audio was bad, he would have included it in the email. So I'm assuming and or guessing that the audio was better yesterday, so that there's a roughly 60-70% chance that it's just one of the audio, virtual audio USB lines in software is getting corrupted for some stupid reason.
I spaced. I forgot about the fifth Wednesday. Right, right. So 2 weeks. And by now, by then, you will have probably figured it out some other way. Anyhow. Yeah, okay. Well, good luck with that. I hope it's nothing too much of a pain in the butt to fix.
Well, we'll see. I mean, hopefully it'll just be, I'll reboot it the next time and you won't mention anything about it and we'll just go on from there. Because that's, you know, again, that's not an infrequent problem with Windows. It just decides to be constipated at times.
Yeah, I guess you need some Windex to clean it. Anyway, back to you.
It's just something you learn to live with Windows. You can't, with Linux, it's theoretically possible to keep a Linux server going continuously for months. I would never do that with a Windows device. Right before I do these things, I tend to reboot them, an hour or two or three before. I just don't trust Windows. It locks up resources. It kind of slows down. Things stop running the way they're supposed to. It just, you know, occasionally I could get about 5 or 6 days worth without rebooting a Windows device. But usually, especially when I do these broadcasts, I don't tempt fate.
Yeah, does Windows still do the thing where they'll suddenly decide to do an update even though you're in the middle of doing important work and you can't control it, or do they still do that?
I haven't experienced that in the longest time, but I did have an experience like that with my Apple TV, much to my annoyance.
Watching something and right in the middle of it, it just did all that. That's pretty bad.
Yeah, I was amazed and astounded, but it just kind of blinked out, and the usual thing of assimilating an update, and then it came back on. I do not know why it decided to do that, I would think that it would either, you know, check to see if someone's pushing buttons on it, or if it's, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, but no, it was something like 8 o'clock at night, and I was pushing buttons, and it just went bye-bye, you have a new upgrade.
I didn't know Apple did that stuff. I never heard of a Mac doing it, but, anyway. They all have problems. I mean, I guess, yeah, those things I don't like about Windows, I guess that's why I put up with the things that Apple throws at you. But it's one thing or another, I guess. I guess all those Unix-based operating systems are better, because Apple's Unix-based, and of course Linux is based on Unix. So.
Yeah, Unix is built like a tank. It is old, but it was built beautifully. Whereas Windows is like a bunch of tinker toys from, you know, five different generations of children.
Well, Unix, I guess in the old days, the only people that were on computers a lot were very serious professionals or nerds. I mean, you know, people are just, they really knew, they were very techie people, and they just did it right, I guess.
Well, Unix, I think, initially was Bell Labs. Smart people, those guys in Bell Labs. And then the universities tinkered with it. Berkeley Systems, part of Berkeley University, it was kind of the basis for the Linux kernel. So, you know, BSD, Unix, and all the other flavors of Unix. But it all began with AT&T.
I've read some of those brief things. When I was into that stuff, yeah, and Linux, so, like, of course, they wanted to make, all this. I mean, it was just they wanted to, because Unix was expensive, so Lainey Torvald, and with lots of help, they just wanted to write something from scratch that would be free and open source, and so that's where that came from.
Yeah, Linus is still an important player in that group. He kind of open sourced it, and a lot of people put in a lot of time building things on top of the kernel and building a graphic user interface and compilers and all kinds of stuff. There's a lot of man hours put into a free piece of operating system software, although a bunch of commercial companies have sort of bought up different flavors of Linux and kind of ruin the whole thing to a degree. But, you know, there's an almost infinite number of different builds for Linux these days.
And there are always some that are more, I guess the ones that are not so bought up, but they can't make the, unlike BSD, which was kind of free, but it was, they allowed Apple and people like that to proprietize it, even the source code, and whereas Linux, I guess it's just the kernel itself they have to keep open source, but they can put stuff on top of it that's not open source, I guess. But I know, yeah, you know, because of course Linux, it was like he built that, the kernel, and all that, a lot of the other stuff was already in place by people like Richard Stallman with the, all the other applications and the shells and all those things, and, but they needed a kernel. Anyway, you know all that, but maybe someone else out there is learning something from all this. But, yeah, it's fascinating, all that history, what I know about it, and there's a lot more I don't know about it.
Yeah, it's intriguing, and I got into trouble with that as well. I made some comment about how MS-DOS has a strange history. IBM went to a digital something or other company owned by a professor for CPM, which was the operating system for 8086 chips. And this guy didn't want to sign a non-disclosure act and didn't want to really talk to IBM. So IBM went over to Bill Gates, who didn't have an operating system, and said, we need an operating system. Can do you have one? And Bill Gates, being Bill Gates, said, sure I do. And what he really ended up doing is he found some guy who had a kind of copy of CPM and bought a eternal license to it and kind of built it into MS-DOS. So, you know, the guy who really deserved the money was a professor who didn't like IBM, and Bill Gates, who was a good programmer but not particularly the best programmer in the world, was one of the best businessmen in the world, and he screwed this guy. And there was one particular guy who was a professor of computers on Limark TechNet who got very upset with me that, you know, Bill Gates is an angel. He didn't steal anything. He just saw an opportunity, and he's a very smart man. So I got into trouble on that one.
He probably is a very smart man. Doesn't mean he's very ethical. Yeah, I didn't know that exactly. I knew something about the CPM, but I just knew it. I didn't know very little about it. That's very interesting. Of course, Steve Jobs was also much more of a great, well, not just businessman, but also a kind of a whiz at design interface, but of course, you know, Wozniak was the real computer guy that knew the real techie, really good at the techie stuff.
Yeah, well, Wozniak was the engineer. He still is a brilliant engineer. He figured out all kinds of ways to bend and twist the laws of physics to be able to accomplish things. His partner in crime, he was just he wasn't a technological guy, and I don't know if he was a genius. He was a sociopath, most likely, and a very demanding boss, and kind of set the pattern for a lot of the Silicon lunatics. You know, he made everyone's life kind of miserable. But, you know, he was effective. You know, he had a rocky history, though. I mean, he was fired from Apple before he came back and made it a multi-billion dollar company. He wasn't smart, but he was aggressive and manipulative, and he sort of had an understanding for what people wanted and gave it to them. So he was a great businessman, but probably a terrible parent and a terrible person, but, you know, you can't have everything.
Actually, I read his biography by Walter Isaacson. You know, that guy. I think I wrote the one about Eisenstein, which I also read. Einstein, Ben Franklin, Da Vinci, unfortunately also Elon Musk. But but anyway, yeah, I read the four, not that last one I mentioned, biographies either. Yeah, I read the one of Steve Jobs. It was very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it gave a generation of managers a wrong message, where everyone is just, treating everyone like a worthless piece of crap, and they, because that's what Steve did.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. He also screwed himself in the end, because he was really insistent on natural remedies and stuff, and he had a form of pancreatic cancer that they thought probably could have been saved, but he just refused at first to get surgery, and he tried all these holistic stuff, and then finally it got worse, and he said, all right, surgery, but it was too late. And a lot of opinions that he could have probably lived if he had been smart and gotten the surgery 9 months earlier.
AC2GS. I agree. He had a very good chance of beating it if he wasn't such a kook. And he was a kook. There were a lot of kooky things he did. I don't know if he had a thing about eating things of a certain color or something, but a lot of things that he did were kind of a demonstration that was something mentally wrong with him. He's functional. He's very functional. There's a big theory that goes around that functional sociopaths make great CEOs, because they don't have any moral center. They don't feel shame. They don't feel sorry for anyone. So they kind of go for the throat. So, and he killed himself. Basically, his weirdness killed him in the end.
Maybe, yeah. So I guess we'll do the puzzle, save it for next time.
Yeah, I thought we should save it to next time. Unfortunately, what we seem to have is kind of serial participants, and usually no more than two at a time. So, I would theoretically like to have at least three people at the same time for things like that. And plus, we filled the time with all the other stuff. And, if we don't have time for one or the other, I'd rather go with conversation than with a puzzle.
Fine. That's what I figured. Yeah, it's there. It's there for next time. So I guess that's in, 3 weeks, I guess.
Yep. It's, I think, the 12th of February. Time flies. You blink, and all of a sudden, it's going to be 2026.
And onward.
Yeah, hopefully onward. Well, Bob, always a pleasure. I thank you for sitting here next to me and keeping me company.
Roy, and thank you for your technical assistance, and it's always very interesting chatting with you. I enjoy it thoroughly. So I guess I'm going to wrap things up, unless, I guess, it's up to you. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I think we kind of did what we came here to do. I'd be surprised if someone kind of yelled out, I have a question. I'll give everyone that couple of, 10, 20 seconds to try and do that. And if nothing, then I think we did a good thing here. We took it for more than 2 hours, which is incredible. I think activity is a little bit more active these days in Limark's TechNet as well. Something magical about the year turning over or something. But I think we did good. So, hopefully next time we'll do good as well.
Good. Yeah. So I'll say 73s, and I'm here to hear your final or your 73s. Till next time. I'll be on the meeting. I'll be on the screen. 73, Roy.
Okie doke, 73. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be February 5th, which will be a virtual meeting using Zoom software. Club members will be emailed with the details of the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required Zoom link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m., and we also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. We offer an audio stream of the KC2RC repeater on the internet as well as our 10-meter net. Just type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by a local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight, especially my co-host Bob, KD2NVV. Without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Have a great week. Stay warm. Be well. And we'll talk to you down the line. AC2GS clear.